Okay, in the limited time that I have, I'd just like to address some of the concerns of and objections of Jeff. Again, with the religious confusion, I'll just add this to it. He assumes every human being is honestly seeking God or honestly open to God's existence. And according to theism, this is especially Christian theism, this is not the case. He alluded to Romans 1:18-22. I believe within each individual is a drive for human autonomy. We want to be our own kings. We want to sit on the throne. But there's also God's place within our heart a thirst for Him. And some of us favor the human autonomy. Some of us favor the thirst for God. The scriptures teach, seek Him and you will find Him. So I basically believe God has given us clear evidence. I just believe that we are very good about lying to ourselves and only accepting or interpreting the evidence the way we would like to. Jeff stated that naturalists don't believe the universe popped into existence out of nothing. And he said the universe is just there. He said the universe doesn't come from anywhere. Well, to me, it sounds the same as saying the universe doesn't come from anywhere. It came from nowhere. And so it seems to me like we're just calling nothing by a different name. He talked about, the continuing existence of the universe, okay? My argument does not commit the fallacy of composition. My argument does not deal with emergent properties. Philosophers draw a distinction between emergent properties and additive properties. An emergent property would be that the whole of the elephant is more than the sum of its parts, okay? My argument utilizes additive properties. If all the tiles on a floor are green, then the entire floor is green. If all the aspects of the universe, all the parts of the universe are dependent, then the whole universe is dependent. Now, the atheist could say, no, maybe there's a part of the universe that is independent. Okay, well, number one, that's not a scientific statement because we haven't found that part of the universe yet. And number two, then this independent part of the universe would be the ground of the dependent part of the universe. In other words, the more that we look at this independent part of the universe, the more it begins to look like what the theist calls God. So I think the argument, Aquinas' argument from the contingent existence of the universe is rather strong. The design argument, I did address it. I did speak about Michael Behe's work. He calls it Darwin's black box. Darwin made a lot of assumptions about the evolution on the molecular level, and now we've opened up those black boxes and we've actually looked there, and so now Michael Behe is saying things like that. Incidentally, scientists who believe in God or reality beyond nature are much more common than popular media stories lead one to believe. There is no reason to think that the figure of 90% of the general population that believes in God is much different from scientists. Ken Miller, whose argument from imperfection I analyzed in the last chapter, is like myself a Roman Catholic, and he makes the point in public talks that belief in evolution is quite compatible with his religious beliefs. I agree with him that they are compatible. The compatibility or lack of compatibility, however, is irrelevant to the scientific question of whether Darwinian evolution of biochemical systems is true. Arno Penzias states that astronomy leads us to a unique event, a universe which was created out of nothing, one with a very delicate balance needed to provide exactly the conditions required to permit life, and one which has an underlying, one might say, supernatural plan. Cosmologist Edward Harrison deduced, here is the cosmological proof of the existence of God, the design argument of Paley, updated and refurbished. The fine-tuning of the universe provides prima facie evidence of deistic design. Take your choice, blind chance that requires multitudes of universes, or design that requires only one. Many scientists, when they admit their views, incline toward the teleological or design argument. And I can go on and on with quotes from Alan Sandage, winner of the Crawford Prize. He stated, I find it quite improbable that such order came out of chaos. There has to be some organizing principle. God to me is a mystery, but is the explanation for the miracle of existence why there is something instead of nothing. He said he doesn't believe the universe popped into existence out of nothing. That is Jeff. But it seems to me that our choice, basically boils down to this. You either got an all-powerful God. I can't explain how God created the universe out of nothing. But a miracle-working, all-powerful God creating the universe out of nothing sounds a lot more plausible than total nothingness producing the universe out of nothing. Again, he denies that that's where he's coming from, but he says that the universe doesn't come from anywhere. It's just there. Is he just ignoring the Big Bang model? Is he just ignoring the second law of thermodynamics? Carl Sagan believed in the oscillating model. And it was his hope that maybe someday, 1,500 years from now, science would vindicate him. Well, that means his view is not scientific. Scientific evidence went against his view. Okay, the fine-tuning of the universe, many are turning at this point to the many universes model, the world ensemble model. An infinite number of parallel universes exist. They don't overlap, therefore we can't confirm their existence. Well, this isn't science. This is speculation, mere speculation. Astrophysicist Hugh Ross says it's a flagrant abuse of probability theory. It assumes the benefits of an infinite sample size without any evidence that the sample size exceeds one. But when you look at theories of quantum physics, in an attempt to get around the Big Bang model, quantum tunneling, which pretty much tries to argue the universe pops into existence out of nothing without a cause. But then J.P. Moreland, Christian philosopher, points out that the nothing that they're talking about really isn't a nothing, it's a something. So they're really denying the Big Bang model or choosing to ignore it, because nothing equals no space, no time, no matter, no energy, no rules of quantum physics. Nothing is not an entity which has an equal amount of positive and negative properties. Nothing is nothing. And so many scientists are actually saying, well, really, you know, they're redefining nothing as something. Well, that's fine. Well, where does something come from? And then it doesn't address the Big Bang model, which teaches that the space, time, energy universe had a beginning. And I still can't see how naturalism is an explanation at all. You're going back to Bertrand Russell's quote against Frederick Copleston in their famous debate, it's just there. It's just, that's a non-explanation. It's just there. We now have evidence the universe had a beginning. We need to ask how it got there and not just say it's not there. With atheism, there's the ethical naturalism position, which reduces moral values to biological or psychological properties. It's still a rejection of a true ought, universal moral values. Non-cognitive views of ethics, again, I reject the idea that moral statements are true or false. So neither of these leading atheistic views, explanations of morality, can consistently condemn the torturing of innocent babies as being universally wrong.
Which speech are we in? I lost track.
We are now at the 5-minute closing statement for both of you.
Sorry about that. I got so caught up, I lost track. I want to make one point about the Big Bang model and the beginning of the universe. I'm going to paraphrase him. He says, but naturalism or atheism mystifies the beginning of the universe. It says it's just a brute fact. It offers no explanation, whereas theism explains it. I guess what I want to say is, notice there's going to be brute facts no matter what you believe. In every metaphysical theory, there's going to be brute facts. It is impossible for a theory to explain absolutely everything, even its own basic assumptions. Even theism has a brute fact, namely why God exists instead of absolutely nothing. But what about naturalism's brute fact, that the universe exists instead of just nothing? I guess I just don't see the problem here. To paraphrase theistic philosopher George Mavrides, if I'm saying his name correctly, what's deep in a naturalistic world is matter and energy. So if there's going to be some sort of a brute fact, what else would the brute fact be on naturalism? I don't see the problem here. I don't think Dr. Fernandez addressed any of my arguments for naturalism in his last speech, so I want to go right into my closing statement. And I want to say that if there's one thing the two of us do agree on, it's that this debate has barely scratched the surface. And since the time limits prevented both of us from saying all of our arguments, I don't think anyone should make any life-changing decisions solely on the basis of this 1-2-hour debate. But I do hope that this debate has caused you to ask questions, begin your own investigation into the evidence, and to read more than just authors who agree with your position. My investigation began about 11 years ago, and it's still ongoing. In that time, I've traveled the full religious spectrum, from a creationist Christian, similar to Dr. Fernandez, to a liberal Christian, to a deist, to an agnostic, to a naturalist. And I would guess that a lot of you probably fall somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. Most of you probably agreed with some of what I've said, and some of what Dr. Fernandez has said. In other words, I recognize that naturalism and theism are not the only two philosophical games in town. Even if you ultimately decide to reject naturalism, you still have plenty of other choices left besides theism in general, and Christian fundamentalism specifically. Consider my opponent's evidence for theism. He says he's provided a cumulative case, but not all of his arguments show that the theistic God exists. In order to show that theism is true, each of his arguments has to show the existence of a supernatural being that is all-powerful, all-knowing, all-good, creator of the universe, transcendent, and immanent. He hasn't even come close. With all due respect, Dr. Fernandez's so-called cumulative case for theism is like a stack of leaky buckets. No matter how many leaky buckets you add to the stack, you still don't have anything that holds water. But now consider my evidence for naturalism. Nothing mental happens without something physical happening. Complex living things evolve from simple living things. Our nervous systems are not fine-tuned so that we only feel physical pain when it would aid survival. Very few sentient beings thrive, even less thrive for most of their lives. There's an abundance of tragedy in the world. Many of the victims of those tragedies never feel God's comforting presence. If there is a God, he's not clearly revealed the religious path he wants us to take, and non-belief is reasonable. Therefore, I think that the evidence clearly shows that naturalism is more probable than theism.
Okay, basically what I tried to do today was show that there are several different pieces of evidence for theism. It's a cumulative case. That means evidence accumulates with each argument. So Jeff totally misunderstands what a cumulative case is. I'm not saying each and every argument proves everything about the theistic God. I'm saying that as you take a piece of this argument, a piece of that argument, it starts moving in that direction. And that in each and every one of these points, theism is more reasonable to accept than naturalism or atheism. We talked about the origin of the universe. Jeff says with Bertrand Russell, it's just there. Apparently that's not good enough for most people on earth who believe in the existence of some type of God. The continuing existence of the universe, I explain why it does not commit the fallacy of composition. That all dependent existence must have its existence grounded in independent existence. I talked about the design and order found in the universe. And atheists are talking about an infinite number of parallel universes that no one's ever seen to try to wipe out the blind faith of the theist. It makes me wonder, you know, who has blind faith in particular debates like this. Universal moral laws. If you can't say that, you know, atheists protest to try to make this world a better place to live. Well, they're introducing not only a moral law, a moral standard, but a moral standard that they judge even the past on and the present and the future. They want to make the world a better place to live. Well, it seems to me that if that is the case, they're appealing to an eternal, unchanging moral standard. Okay? The absurdity of life without God is not appealed to emotions. If everything you accomplish, if you find out that you build a bridge today, somebody's going to blow it up tomorrow, why build the bridge today? And if atheism is true, it's going to all be blown up. That's not appeal to emotion. That's just the way things are. Talked about the laws of logic and mathematics. Jeff agreed to the existence of the laws of logic. Well, that's some kind of funny-looking furniture in a naturalistic universe. I mean, if everything has physical causes, how did these invisible, unchanging laws of logic, like the law of non-contradiction, just kind of either pop into existence, or maybe they were just there, these invisible entities? Hey, if you're gonna slam a Christian for believing in this invisible God, well, why do you believe in the invisible laws of logic? Many atheists do not, but apparently Jeff does. Jeff stated that I have the burden of proof in this debate. Not so. This debate is not, does God exist? Where the burden of proof rests on the man arguing for the affirmative. This is theism versus naturalism. My worldview versus his worldview. Nobody has the burden of proof in a debate like this. I will not accept a debate with the title, Does God Exist? Because it places an unfair burden of proof on myself. sanctity of human life. He admitted that human life, it might be special, but it is not sacred if naturalism is true. Well, that's why the naturalists, the atheists, in the old Soviet Union and in China have killed over 100 million people during peacetime, 100 million of their own people, because human life is not sacred. Once you throw the sanctity of human life out the window, everything else goes with it. In theism, human life is sacred because man was created in God's image, and therefore human life is sacred. Our founding fathers recognized this, although they weren't very consistent with it, that all men are created equal. Charles Darwin did not argue that all men and all women have evolved equally. Okay, it just doesn't follow from the naturalistic position. As far as human free will, and really didn't get a chance to talk about this, but basically, if everything is determined by physical causes, even our decisions, then how can we hold somebody accountable for something that really wasn't their choice? It was just chemically determined. And in closing, the fact of God's existence, I do not believe that it is a mystery. I believe it's clearly seen through his created effects. But since he is infinitely wise, many of his ways and thoughts are often mysterious to us. If I could tell you why God does everything that he does, then it wouldn't be the God of theism. This debate is about God's existence. It's not about attaining an exhaustive knowledge of the workings of an infinitely wise God. On those points that I spoke about, theism is more reasonable than naturalism. Thank you.
A round of applause, I think, is due again for our two-point contestant. We will reassemble in a few minutes. We've got a couple of people here who'd like to take a little bit of a breather and have a little drink of water. Let's get back together in, let's say, 5 minutes to 3:10. Okay, 10 minutes, 3:15, according to consensus. And we'll have 45 minutes of question and answer. Microphone here. It's very difficult to hear, from often far corners of the universe. Anthony's going to be running up and down this side. If you have a question, I'd like if you could get sort of over here to be recognized, and we'll try and do something in some reasonable order so that Anthony can get to you. What I'd like you to do is to direct a question toward one or the other of our debaters. We'll give a brief opportunity to give a response, and then, like a 30-second rebuttal from the one who was not initially asked, if that's agreeable to both of you.
What's the format again? They'll
direct a question to one or the other of you. An answer will be forthcoming, and then the one who was not asked will have a chance to come up with a brief 30-second response.
How long is the initial answer?
Three minutes? I'm thinking 3 minutes will work.
Okay.
Okay, I think we have the mic working.
Down here, gentlemen, right down in front here. My question is for you, Phil. I have a comment and then a question. My comment is that I think that you suffer from a kind of a common misunderstanding as to what science is. Your idea when you were talking about the many worlds theory was that was science. I think that's what you said. And I want to submit for you the idea that science is a system for evaluating claims or evaluating the validity of claims as opposed to the common misunderstanding of what science is, which commonly people think science is what scientists say. That's my comment. My question is, if there is a God, why was he such a bad designer? I could give the example of my back. My back today... And if you talk to surgeons, as I have, they will tell you this is an incredible weak link in the human system. It was just a bad design. I am no God, but I could design a better back than the one I am afflicted with. My surgeon who did back surgery on me a couple of years ago, who thinks he is a God, he redesigned my back for me. He went in with a chisel he opened up a channel through which my nerve goes, and I suffer a lot less because of that redesign.
I think, did a better job, even though he's a much smaller God than the one you speak of.
I think we have the question here.
Okay, I'd like to say four things. First off, I'd like to preface this with the fact that I kind of have gained more of an appreciation for Daniel in the lion's den. Because I have the impression that there's going to be a lot of people saying that I suffer from something here, and I understand that, and I'm very grateful that you're very gracious, sometimes more gracious than some of my Christian brothers and sisters are to me, with expressing our disagreements. But secondly, it really wasn't a disagreement. Maybe I didn't articulate my position well. I was saying exactly that this wild speculation is not really scientific. But a lot of people, maybe possibly lay people, that are defending the non-theistic position are using it as if it is. Scientifically proven data.
I didn't say that it's not scientific. I just said it was a claim that needs to be evaluated.
Mm-hmm.
And it hasn't been sufficiently evaluated.
Yeah, and I think some of those claims, it is, by principle, they can't be evaluated. I hate to bring up, use Anthony Flew's falsibility principle against himself, but basically, like parallel universes, in principle. You can't look at them and examine them. There's no overlap. But you mentioned God as a bad designer. Number one, he was at least a good enough designer so that your back could be fixed. There's a healing process in human bodies so that your miniature God doctor could fix. I mean, what's the sense of fixing a broken arm if it's not going to heal? So there's a healing process there. But I don't think God's that bad of a designer. I'm a Christian theist, so I do believe God created the universe perfect, created Adam and Eve with perfect backs. We fell in the garden, and there's a lot of built-in consequences to encourage us to get back in the right direction.
Okay. Real briefly, I just want to make two points. First, concerning many universes, I want to make it very clear that I never actually said that I believe that there are multiple universes. Remember, I was appealing to Occam's razor, and I just said that if you don't accept my claim that the alleged fine-tuning of the universe is improbable on naturalism, well, you could just as easily say there are many universes as you could say that there are God. And that would be providing an explanation in terms of the known. If you appeal to theism, that's an explanation in terms of the unknown. As far as having a bad back, I sympathize with you. I sometimes have back problems myself. And I want to emphasize that this is something that you would expect given evolutionary naturalism. We evolved from ape-like ancestors, and given that they were not upright, this is exactly what you would expect if evolution is true.
All right, we have a second question right here.
Yes, Phil, there's so many questions I could ask you, but I feel compelled to ask one. I'm an evolutionary paleontologist, and I knew Colin Patterson, the late Colin Patterson.
Mm-hmm.
The quote you gave was quoted incredibly out of context.
Mm-hmm.
He believes in transitional species, he believes in transitional fossils, and in what he has stated throughout his career is that you can't pinpoint transitional fossils within a cladistic framework. That means an analysis of species using cladism, which is a type of taxonomy. Now, without that restriction, he would recognize transitional fossils, as do many, many other paleontologists and scientists. So my question to you is, would you please investigate the source of that quotation and get it correct, or else please drop it from your presentation, because it is scurrilous. And he has spent many years trying to get away from that, because that's not what he believes.
Okay, well, yeah, I would say this. I am not a scientist, and if I mistakenly used the quote, I apologize. I'll look further into it. At the same time, I was invited here. So if you want a greater scientific mind than Phil Fernandez has, and believe me, there are plenty, you could have got, If you want a major leaguer, you guys can go get a major leaguer. I'll give you a whole list of them. The William Lane Craigs, the J.P. Morelands that know a lot more than Phil Fernandez does. But this is what you got. And if I am wrong, I stand corrected. I'll look further into it. But I do not claim to be a better philosopher than the philosophers are here today. I do not claim to be a better scientist, not even a scientist, than the scientists who are here today. All I claim is that I believe there is good, solid evidence for Christian theism. And I believe I presented some good evidence, and maybe I missed the boat on one area or another, and I'll look into it, and thank you very much.
Okay. stuff here.
I appreciate Dr. Fernandez's gracious willingness to reinvestigate the source of that quotation, because I really do think that this was a quotation out of context, and I don't blame him for that per se. I blame Luther Sunderland. When Patterson was talking about transitional forms, he was referring to his 1978 book entitled Evolution. And if you read that book, you'll see that Patterson believes that we do possess several examples of transitional forms in the fossil record. He says, in mammals, for example, the gap between horses, asses, and zebras, and their closest living relatives, the rhinoceroses and tapirs, is filled by an extensive series of fossils extending back 60 million years to a small animal, which I don't know how to pronounce, Hyracotherium, which can only be distinguished from the rhinoceros tapir group by one or two horse-like details of the skull. So I think it's pretty clear Colin Patterson does believe that there are transitional forms.
Next question.
Thank you. Similar to Steve's comment, I just wanted to ask Dr. Fernandez a quick question. I was attracted to this mainly to hear your positions as described as reasonable or scientifically supported. I'll leave the reason and logic aspects of the philosopher's present. I'm a psychologist. Of the scientific evidence you cited, 100% of it with which I'm familiar, which is not all of it, but 100% of it with which I am familiar, was either outdated, unrepresentative of the field, or completely inverted. And the example I would give was when you were addressing the research by Penfield and Rasmussen and Sperry and other psychophysiologists, where electrodes were implanted in brains and thoughts occurred, memories occurred, movements occurred, you then attributed that as support for a theistic position because the metaphysical realm of decision-making was not addressed. That is not what they were searching. Mm-hmm. None of those researchers you cited concluded that this was evidence for anything metaphysical. It was exactly the opposite, 180 degrees, that things that appear metaphysical to us, that appear non-physical and are in a realm of metaphysics or paranormal or paranatural called consciousness or mind. This was evidence against that because things that appear to us to be paranatural turn out to be entirely physical. So that's another area along Steve's line. I would just ask for your response in general in terms of the quality of the scientific data and the accuracy with which you're quoting it. But on that specific one, I guarantee you all that work and the replications thereof reached exactly the opposite conclusion of the points you used in your argument.
And I would again say now, what I've read of that particular, those particular experiments, it did seem to me that there were surprises. They did not get what exactly it was that they were looking for. At the same time, you know, there are plenty of scientists who are Christians out there. And if you want someone more versed in it, go and get them. And I would like to make one suggestion, though. I would thought that this particular question and answer period would be limited to like a 1 minute question and a 2 minute response by both, no matter who it's related to, because otherwise, because this room is filled with friends of Jeff Lauder, it's actually going to work against him. But it might seem like I'm on the spot, but basically I'm getting 3 minutes to respond. He only gets 30 seconds. So what if we go with 2 minutes?
Well,
and 2 minutes?
We can go 2 and 2 then. As long as the crucial thing is that we wrap this thing up in about 30 minutes from now. Jeff, do you have any
crucial things? I get on my plane.
Yeah, that's right.
And get out of town.
The only thing. All right. We've got a question at the back of the room here.
Thank you. Since all the other questions were prefaced by a 30-second comment, I'd like to make a comment. As a Christian theist who attended the entire conference, I would like to thank you who put this on, the work that you did. I thought the conference went very well. I thought there were a lot of stimulating papers, and I've got a lot to think about and consider when I go back to Charlotte, so I want to express my thanks. My question is to Mr. Lauder. I thought I heard you concur with Dr. Fernandez's commitment to the dictum or the law that everything that begins to exist has a cause of its existence. But then later, I thought I heard you say that time and space began to exist but did not need a cause. And if you said those, how would you resolve that contradiction?
Yes, actually, that's not quite what I said, and this is a very subtle distinction, so this is probably a good thing for me to try and explain again what my position is. What I said is that anything that begins to exist in space and time has a cause. William Lane Craig, for example, in his debates, I think I once heard him talk about the absurdity of believing that you could sit in your living room watching TV and a tiger could just pop into existence in your living room out of nothing. That would be an example of an event in space and time, and I agree that that would be absurd to say that something like that could happen. What I'm saying is there's a difference between that kind of an event and the origin of space and time itself. All of our experiences, our metaphysical intuitions, all of the support that Craig Fernandez and other theists have brought in support of their causal principle, I think are just completely irrelevant to the very origin of space and time, and therefore I see no reason at all to believe that the beginning of the universe, if the Big Bang Theory is true, needs a cause.
And I would basically respond, and he doesn't like the Thomistic argument from dependency, if all the things in nature need a cause, then when you collect them all together, you get one big group of dependent things that still need a cause for their continuing existence. So I think that the law of causality within space and time argues, or at least favors very strongly, the theistic position that therefore the whole collection of these dependent things needs a cause.
All right, we have a question over here then.
Yes, I want to mention a point of agreement with Dr. Fernandez, and that's that we both agree on the laws of logic. So I just want to check with two premises of your syllogism if we can agree on the conclusion. Because in talking about the problems of the human concept of infinity, you said infinity doesn't exist except as a concept in the human mind. Then you said God is infinite. Can we then conclude that, therefore, God doesn't exist except as a concept within the human mind?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. The only problem is, sir, and I don't mean it in any bad way, but you're misreading me. I said that an actual infinite set cannot exist outside of a mind. So if there's an actual infinite set of things that can exist in a mind, guess what kind of mind it would be? It would be an actually infinite mind. And so basically what I'm arguing is that God knows an actually infinite number of things. Now, you can't get there through successive addition, so that means he must know them innately in one eternal glance. Now, this is Thomism, you know, Thomas Aquinas and that type of thing, and you may reject it, but I'm not saying an actual infinite set can exist in a human finite mind. I'm saying it can exist in a mind, but when we look at what kind of mind it's got to be an infinite mind. So I don't see a real glaring problem there. Now, if you explain me how an infinite mind can know an infinite number of things, I'd say go ask the infinite mind.
I haven't really talked about the possibility of an actual infinite because for purposes of this debate, it's irrelevant to my position because I accept the fact of Big Bang Theory. So there would be no point in me defending the possibility of an actual infinite because I don't believe that the universe is infinitely old. That's all I have to say.
We have another question toward the back of the room here.
My question is for Jay. It seemed that throughout the debate, especially the opening remarks, you made a number of observations. To name a few, tragedies occurring, biological role of pain and pleasure, as well as religious confusion. I believe that you preceded these observations by saying that given these particular occurrences and observations, which I named, the existence of God or theism seems rather unreasonable or improbable. If that's correct, my question is this. Where is it that you're getting your information from that leads you to believe that theism or God's existence would be improbable given these things? That is, how are you determining this probability?
To really address your question, I'd have to talk about a specific argument. But in general, I thought I answered this in my speech. I tried to explain why, given some fact about our world, that would be surprising. It would not be what we would expect given theism. Several of my arguments, you'll notice, had to do with things that we would that I say are improbable on theism because they are facts that would only be true if God had a morally sufficient reason for allowing them. And in my speech, I tried to argue that the odds that there were such a moral reason is pretty unlikely. I tried to argue that it was more likely on naturalism than on theism. Technically, what I'm using is epistemic conditional antecedent probability. I don't know if that answers your question. It's hard to talk in generalities. We'd have to go into a specific argument.
I would say that basically just in response to that, that the theist doesn't have to argue that this is the greatest possible world, but he would have to argue this is the greatest possible way to achieve the greatest possible world, i.e. what the Bible calls heaven, and that God often uses evil and human suffering to draw people to himself. Now, God's ways and thoughts are far above our understanding, even the scriptures state that. So at best, atheistic arguments show that limited minds cannot fully understand why God allows so much evil, but that's only expected if you believe in the existence of an infinite God. And only God knows the right amount of evil and human suffering. I mean, where do you draw the line? So we draw the line all the way back so that only one guy on earth doesn't get saved. Well, then the atheist would still scream, well, that's unfair. That's too much suffering because he's the only one that's not going to heaven. So where do you draw the line? I believe God knows where to draw the line, and he brings about the greatest good, which I believe is the maximum amount of people in heaven fellowshipping with him for all eternity.
We have a question over here.
Hi, Mr. Fernandez, I realize that you may not have had all the time you would have liked to address Mr. Lauder's questions and his points during his argument, but I'd like to give you a chance to rectify that because I really would like a bit more explanation on why God is silent. Say, for instance, during Mr. Lauder's description of a 3-year-old child with leukemia, why isn't God like that towards people who have such tragedies?
Yeah, and I think I basically responded to in the last question that basically, as Isaiah 55, 8, and 9 says, that God's ways and his thoughts are often as far above ours as the heavens are above the earth. I cannot give you an answer for every particular reason, but I do think that the evidence that I provided, the origin of the universe, the continuing existence of the universe, the existence of absolute moral values, design and complexity found in the universe, demand that there be an infinite being to ground the existence of the universe. Now, I'm not saying that, therefore, we can fully and exhaustively know the ways of this God. I do think that many theists pretend to know all the reasons why God allows evil and human suffering. If someone's in here and your baby died, I'll give you a hug and a shoulder to cry on, but I'm probably not going to give you a philosophical answer. Now, anybody who tells you that they've got the God of the Bible all figured out, it's not the God of the Bible.
Well, I guess I would just say in response to that, again, even if God, assuming that there were a God, and he had reasons for allowing tragedies like a 3-year-old with leukemia, reasons that were too complicated for us little humans to understand, I still have not heard any reason at all why God does not consistently comfort people who are victims of these tragedies. And again, if you were the parent of a 3-year-old son with leukemia who had to go get chemotherapy twice a week, he wouldn't be in doubt about your love, and he certainly wouldn't be in doubt about your existence. So I think this is just really strong evidence for naturalism.
Another question here, then.
This is for Dr. Fernandez. I'm wondering about the idea of a part-time God. And what I mean by that is I hear people describe themselves as people persons. And then the theistic explanation of the universe and all of that seems to presuppose a people-oriented God. If we have a people-oriented God, then it would seem that if God is omniscient, omnipresent and all that, that our concerns could be taken care of in no time flat. But my real concern, I guess, is what does God do when he's not worrying about people? There are pieces of the universe that we will never see, that no person will ever see. Why would we have a God who is concerned with people, who then has other chunks of the universe out there that are totally irrelevant to us? Presumably, he's playing cat's cradle or something like that. I don't know.
Well, I think it's a good question. I think if God created a fairly small universe so he could explore every inch of it in a small amount of time, then I think the atheist objection would be, well, God doesn't have to be all-powerful because look how small the universe is. I mean, you know, if we had enough time, we could do it ourselves. I think part of this vast, immense universe that we can never totally figure out is God giving us a big clue, and that is that he is infinite in power. He is the creator, and we have this vast universe that we'll never totally figure out. So an atheist, act like the theist, needs to totally figure out his God, or his God is not worthy of belief. I just think it misses the point. But I do think that God created a very big, vast universe so that man can look and give glory to God and have an experience of wonder and awe at this great, vast creation. Obviously, the atheists would disagree.
I don't know. I think this is sort of a draw. I mean, yeah, we've got this really big universe, and you've got the points that Dr. Fernandez brought up, but on the other hand, you've got this really big universe. And I'm reminded of, you know, the movie Contact, based on the book by Carl Sagan, and to paraphrase Dr. Arroway, I mean, it just seems like an awful waste of space. I don't know that that proves anything for naturalism or for theism. I think this is sort of a draw.
This is to Dr. Fernandez. You said that God uses human suffering to test man, to also bring man to him. What about animal suffering? Animals have no stake in salvation whatsoever. Mm-hmm. There can be no justifiable reason for animal suffering. Mm-hmm. What kind of God is that?
Basically, it's another good question, but I believe, you know, I am the type of theist that is called a Christian theist. I suppose traditional Jewish theists also would agree that God created man as the pinnacle of his creation, but then he also created the world and gave man dominion over it. So now we are not to abuse the gifts that God has given us, but I do view the animal kingdom as a gift to mankind. Now, obviously, you step outside of a theistic framework, and if you lower the status of human beings and raise the status of animals, then you can make a case against it, but I don't see any reason to step outside the theistic framework, especially because of things like the Big Bang model and the impossibility of an actual infinite set existing outside of a mind.
Again, I'd go back to my opening statement. You might remember that my fourth line of evidence for naturalism was the flourishing and languishing of sentient beings. Other animals, they're not moral agents. We don't hold a chimpanzee morally responsible for how it behaves. But a chimpanzee is a sentient being. It is capable of feeling pain. And therefore, moral agents, which includes humans, and God, if God exists, are therefore morally responsible for how they treat sentient beings that are not human. And I don't think we've heard any reason at all why theism, if theism is true, we'd find this this pattern that we see with the flourishing and languishing of sentient beings. I think that's an excellent question.
Dr. Fernandez,
I'm sorry, I need to interject here. I'd like to request that we alternate who the question is directed to.
Oh, that's
if there are questions for me, I just...
Yeah.
All right, Dr. Fernandez, you said that evil was necessary for moral perfection. That's incoherent because a tidal wave or a flood that kills thousands of children is hardly character building. And the people who survive with respect to them, like their parents, instead of strengthening their character, the trauma might crush them and they'll be...
Yeah, I didn't say it was necessary for moral perfection, although I do think that some cases of evil are necessary for moral perfection in this fallen world. There would be no such thing as being courageous if there was no evil person to fear. You couldn't love your enemies in a perfect world because we'd all be friends. Things of that sort, but I'm not saying that in every single case it's essential to moral perfection. What I am saying is, in every case, if the all-good, all-powerful God of the Bible does exist, and I believe there is evidence that he does exist, very good evidence that he does exist, that theism is more plausible than naturalism, then there's good evidence that even though we don't know the answers as to why God allowed some horrible incident to occur, we can trust him that he had some greater good reasons for it. And that's exactly what the book of Job is about, so... very ancient book, and it already addressed that question. I think just the fact that the Bible addressed questions that are still current today back that far is evidence in itself that theism is onto something.
I don't know. I go back to my opening statement. I tried to present several lines of evidence with a theme from biology. The pattern of the types of pain and suffering, we find the patterns of pain and suffering. We can talk about things like moral perfection and greater goods, but when it all boils down to it, the fact of the matter is, naturalism has an explanation and theism doesn't.